Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
Okay, my name's Megan Bates from Melbourne, Australia, and I'm a primary school teacher. Also a mum to two boys who are aged 11 and 12. Jump to you, Craig.
So I'm Craig Bates. I live in Melbourne, Australia with Megan, and I work for Microsoft.
And not that long ago, Megan, Craig, their boys, and the rest of Melbourne, Australia emerged from one of the longest, most restrictive COVID lockdowns anywhere in the world.
Gosh, yeah, before life got turned upside down, we were a busy family of four, you know, juggling school, work, the boys' sporting schedules of a weekend. We'd be eating out, we'd be going to the movies and all those sorts of things, I guess, we took for granted. But that all quickly, came to a head in March, where we were all, under lockdown.
You know, in addition to that, I used to travel every week for work. So traveling between Melbourne and Sydney mostly, as well as overseas regularly, going from traveling almost every week to now not having been on a plane for 8 months or so has certainly been a big change for us.
So we were all just, juggling for space and quiet, and I guess the four walls of this house could have been much greater to give us the space we needed at home.
So we went through two phases of lockdown in Melbourne. We had probably some greater challenges than what we did in other parts of Australia. And so the first lockdown, we were confined to home. You were only able to travel to go out and buy essential items or to be able to exercise. And retail, etc., was still open, but with restrictions.
Yeah, I think at first it was a bit of a novelty. The boys were trying to maintain their connections with friends via gaming platforms. But yeah, that soon became really hard on them.
I think we were in that for about 6 weeks or so from memory. And unlike the other states, it got out of hand in Melbourne. So we were getting to hundreds of cases a day, nothing like you're experiencing in the US. And so we put in place a lockdown, which I think then went for about 11 weeks from end of June, I think it is. And that lockdown was pretty severe. It was not allowed to travel 5 kilometres from your house, not allowed to go to work, all businesses shut down. You're only allowed to leave your house for 1 hour to exercise, and everybody needed to wear a mask as well too. And so, it was pretty restrictive and really challenging for a lot of people to get through that time.
You know, you can't turn the TV on without seeing the news. So we involved the boys in what was going on and why we needed to do what we needed to do. One of our boys even did a speech for his house public speaking on the history of pandemics. So he got really right into it. Our premier in our state was on 11 a.m. pretty much every day, giving us an update on the numbers. You know, all of us were in the habit of checking the numbers each day, and I guess that unified us all on achieving the goal of what we needed to work towards. Our politicians gave us the goal, like, if we want to be open by Christmas, we need to just follow the rules. We need to social distance and we need to just stay at home.
Going through later parts of October, I think people were feeling really stretched, right? They were really feeling like this really can't go on much longer. And so it felt difficult at the time, but to be able to look into a Christmas time and a summer holidays for us where everything's back open is the best that we could possibly hope for. So I think everyone feels pretty lucky. Even the people who felt very much against the lockdowns and thought that we were doing the wrong thing there, I think really feel lucky for where we are now.
Craig and Megan Bates from Melbourne, Australia. And where they are now, where all of Australia is basically at zero. Yesterday, across the entire Australian nation, population 26 million, there were just 6 new COVID positive cases. 6. Yesterday in the United States, there were approximately 200,000 new positive cases. You're not impressed? You want population-adjusted figures? Okay, fine. If Australia had as many people as the U.S. does, yesterday, Australia would have had seen 76 new COVID cases. And again, what did we have? 200,000. Well, of course, it did not have to be this way. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, how did Australia do it? Well, let's go right back to Melbourne, where Dina Rosendorf joins us. She's manager of ABC Radio Melbourne. Dina, welcome to On Point, especially given the 16-hour yawning time difference between us.
Thank you so much, Meghna. And there are very few people that I would wake up at this ungodly hour for, but you are one of them.
Full disclosure, in what feels like a previous life, Dina and I work together here in Boston at WBUR. So Dina, tell me, you're there in Melbourne. How restrictive was the lockdown for, what, it was like 3 or 4 months there?
Yeah, it was the better part of 4 months. And listening back to Meghna and Craig talk about their experiences, it brought back a lot of memories, which I can't believe I've already sort of put behind me. But it was incredibly restrictive. You heard them talk about this 5-kilometre radius that was in place. So people were basically just confined to moving around their neighbourhoods when they could move around. We could only get around for about an hour a day for exercise, one trip to the supermarket. Everything was closed, restaurants closed except for takeaway. Obviously, gyms, shops closed. People had to do homeschooling. The roads were empty. And most controversially, there was a curfew. So from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m., we had to remain in our homes. And if you broke that curfew or if you illegally had people over to your house and you were caught, you faced a $5,000 fine. And so what that meant is beyond what you heard Meghna and Craig talk about, is that people had to cancel weddings. They couldn't visit their elderly relatives. They missed funerals. It was hard enough for people like Meghna and Craig who had families with young children, but it was equally hard for people living alone. And, we're still witnessing the long tail of that mental health impact of those restrictions.
Mm. I want to talk to you about that in a second, but tell me a little bit more. You said there was like a 1-hour window every day where people could go grocery shopping and things like that. So how that must have had a terrible impact on people who couldn't do it during that hour or were restricted for other reasons. I mean, how did Melbourne support people like that?
And that was the beauty of this time. As restrictive as it was, you saw people and neighbourhoods coming together, and it didn't have to be at a particular hour. I guess it was sort of personal, up to individual responsibility to be able to say, I'm going to go at this particular time. That's my hour. I'm going to do one walk a day around my neighbourhood. That's my one allotted time of exercise. So it wasn't confined to a particular hour. Hmm. But yeah, I mean, look, in my neighbourhood, and I was homeschooling with kids as well, 3 kids, first lockdown, you heard Craig and Meghna talk about the first lockdown that we had back in April, and it was sweet. You know, there were initiatives around my neighbourhood where people would leave teddy bears in their front windows and kids around the neighbourhood would go around and look at them in the windows and go on bear hunts. By the second lockdown, which was much more restrictive, and that was the one that lasted for a better part of 4 months, we were over it, And, any kind of restrictions on screen time as parents went out the window. And I think still a lot of us are having to wean our children off games like Roblox and Minecraft, But the point is we got through it.
Yeah.
And we're here to tell the tale. And Victoria has just celebrated what we call our 40th Donut Day in a row. We celebrate donut days when we have 0 cases. And, we've had 40 days in a row of no cases off a high of, at one time, 725 cases a day, which I know that, compared to what's happening in the US, that doesn't sound like a lot, as you mentioned at the top of the show. But for us, that was a huge number.
Mm. So it's hard for me, nay, impossible, to not see this through the U.S. lens, Dina. So because what has come along with the pandemic here, of course, is mass unemployment. you know, increasing lines at food banks, things like that. Did the very restrictive lockdown in Australia, particularly in Melbourne, did it have that same impact there?
Yes. I mean, you know, when restaurants, businesses closed down, of course, it had a huge impact. But to the federal government's credit, they flooded the economy with money and support. So we had two schemes, JobKeeper and JobSeeker. So if you had a job but you suddenly became unemployed, you could go on JobKeeper where you got up to $1,200 a fortnight. And JobSeeker was for those people who were already unemployed and it was slightly less. But basically we had financial support for people who had lost jobs. It's wound back a bit, but it is actually still in place and it's expected to be there until March of next year. And so, you know, people had a living wage, but this was also combined with other initiatives such as banks offering a freeze on mortgages for homeowners, rental relief from many landlords for businesses. And you could also access your superannuation, which is like our 401k. Mm-hmm. You could access that early if you needed, you know, to access some money that the government was, they relaxed restrictions around that. So, yes, our economy suffered, but it didn't suffer as badly as you might have expected. And right now, unemployment's hovering at about 7%, which is higher than it has been, but it's certainly not as bad as it could be.
Okay. So we've got about 30 seconds before the first break here, Dina. What's it like to have fewer cases across the entire country than I can count on my two hands?
It's crazy. It's so weird. And we all feel so proud of what we've done to achieve this. And you talked about those six cases, Meghna. Those are from overseas arrivals. So we were really worried about cases that are community transmission. Those aren't community transmission cases. They're from overseas and they're in hotel quarantine now. So Australia has achieved aggressive suppression, which is just incredible.
Well, we are talking this hour with Dina Rosendorf. She's manager of ABC Radio Melbourne, and we're trying to learn how Australia has beaten back the pandemic for now with remarkable success and whether there are any lessons the United States can and should learn. So, Dina, hang on there for just a second. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring how Australia did it, how this nation of more than 25 million people has no community spread right now, zero new cases of community spread of COVID-19 across the entire country of Australia, just a tiny handful, six cases that have come in from overseas. Dina Rosendorf joins us today. She's manager of ABC Radio Melbourne. She's with us from Melbourne, Australia, and we're going to hear from an Australian epidemiologist in just a second. But Dina, I should have asked you earlier. I mean, Australia is a very politically vibrant country. It's had any number of internal, you know, political debates over time. Not everyone, by any stretch of the imagination, walks in lockstep there. But so was there pushback to these incredibly restrictive lockdowns? To the government saying, or state level government in Australia saying, you can't come out of your house except for 1 hour a day for almost 4 months?
Yeah, I mean, look, I make it sound, I mean, looking back with hindsight, it sounds easy, doesn't it? But it wasn't. And by the end of an almost four-month lockdown, there were a lot of angry people out there in Victoria, and there were protests. And, you know, people really were concerned, you know, particularly when I talked about the curfew that we had from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m., people really felt that that was an infringement of our civil liberties. And so there was a lot of anger. But somehow, by and large, we still managed to, as a society, as a collective, we still managed to sort of, I guess, follow the rules and overcome that. I think at a federal level, what we have in Australia is we've got COAG, which is the Council of Australian Government. So you've got all the states and territories, and each of those states and territories have leaders called premiers. In Victoria, we've got the Premier, Daniel Andrews. And they all come together with the federal government led by Scott Morrison, who's the Prime Minister. And they had this system in place because they meet quite regularly every year. So they had that system in place, so an ability to communicate, a bit of structure to talk to one another. So when the pandemic hit, COAG was already in place and they could come together quite quickly. And although there were differences of opinion, by and large, we could sort of at least communicate, and the states and territories could work with the federal government to shut the borders internationally, to manage hotel quarantine to a degree, to implement these economic initiatives, as I mentioned, JobKeeper, JobSeeker previously. So, you know, we were kind of at an advantage in that respect that we could enact a pandemic response relatively smoothly, but it wasn't without pain.
Mm. Well, and in addition to those measures, both political and lockdown, and I've been focusing on the lockdown because of its extreme example, obviously Australia had testing and contact tracing as well. So we're going to hear a little bit more about all of that now from an Australian epidemiologist named Mary Louise McClaws. So Dina, I wonder if you could just stand by a little bit and listen to my conversation that I had with Mary Louise yesterday. But before we do that, I just want to credit ABC Radio Melbourne's breakfast show hosted by Sammy J, because you sent us this lovely little thing. Sammy J wrote a jingle of sorts for when McClaws used to come on or came on his show.
When you're in the middle of a global pandemic, confusion is rife, so you need academic assistance. Consistent and easily digestible public information that's also incontestable. Don't rely on a spy or an apologist. You know who to call. You need an epidemiologist. And who do I seize keeping hold of the cause? It's Mary Louise, surname McClaws.
So that was from the ABC Melbourne's breakfast program hosted by Sammy J.
Yes.
did you know about that?
We all love him. He's a great journalist. He spreads information in the most enjoyable fashion.
I feel like so. I mean, you're a rock star there.
No. Just Sammy J loves me. I'm not a rock star. I'm just an epidemiologist.
So that was from my conversation last night with Mary Louise McClaws, who in fact is an epidemiologist at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. She's also a member of the WHO's Expert Advisory Panel for Infection Prevention, Readiness and Response to COVID-19. And we talked late last night, East Coast time, over Zoom, and I started by asking McClaws to describe the first wave, what happened in Australia during that first wave of COVID that hit the country back in March.
Some modelers provided a what would happen if the borders weren't closed. And they identified that if there wasn't isolation, quarantining, social distancing, that they might need 35,000 intensive care beds. And I think that scared them a lot, because at that time, we only had 7,000 intensive care beds across the country. So I think that our government might have toyed with the idea of a non-scientific herd immunity. But when they heard that from the modelers, I think that the government read the Australian people very well, that they had to do something. So they finally did close their borders. And I think that was the beginning of a good story for Australia.
Australia, of course, is a nation, a continent, and surrounded by water, which I imagine made perhaps border closure, while still difficult, perhaps a more feasible option than other countries might have. So then the numbers go down precipitously to almost nothing until the second surge begins, what, about May or so?
In Victoria, on the 18th of June, they were heading into a point of no return. But generally in Australia, people trust their leaders to look after their health. And yes, there was a small proportion of people who didn't want to wear a mask. And I think that's where the version came of the Karen, where this particular woman was having a meltdown of not wanting to wear a mask in a crowded shop. But mostly everyone complied.
I'm curious about something here in the United States from the beginning, as you know, in the spring. The language was always around flattening the curve so that the healthcare system would not be overwhelmed. I don't recall hearing a single expert in the United States saying, not just flatten the curve, but drive the cases down to zero. Like, that was never in the conversation in this country. But it sounds like that's what Australia has basically achieved twice now. Why was that goal set versus getting it the pandemic down to a level where the healthcare system in Australia could manage it? Because it's a very different set of responses based on the decision.
So Australia will admit that we've never had an elimination protocol. So the federal government closing the border set a scene that said, we're going to protect you. And yes, there was that original idea that we don't want the health system overrun, but the population didn't hear that. The population heard, we don't want you to get sick. That's basically the message that myself and others and commentators, journalists and public health officers pushed. And the population said, okay, that sounds reasonable. And they cooperated. I mean, you're talking to a country when we had a massacre in Port Arthur many years ago that our then Prime Minister, John Howard, said, this should never happen again. All of you who don't live on the farm and don't need a gun, hand your gun in. And we all went, sounds good. Sure, we don't need a gun. So there are people that, of course, shoot for fun, you know, target shooting. They kept theirs, but it has to be under lock and key and have to have a license. But the majority of Australians don't have guns unless they're on a farm. So Australians think of the greater good. I don't think they realise that they're always thinking about what is the good, not just for them, but for everybody else. So I think it is very much a population personality.
Can you describe what the coordination was between the Australian federal government and the state governments? I mean, obviously, I'm asking because there's been an utter lack of coordination here in the United States, which is part of the problem. What was it like there?
Well, it's interesting. So there are two major parties like there are in the United States. And I think that those in opposition realized they weren't going to gain anything by being discordant. But each state and territory often did their own thing. But fortunately, it was very same. I mean, they all closed their borders to each other. The one difference being New South Wales public health had been very well resourced for the last 30 years. So I have a colleague who was trained by the CDC in America, Professor George Rubin, who came back from America and decided that what he liked about the CDC was the training and the shoe leather epidemiologist. So he put in place a similar program in New South Wales Health, which then was built on over 30 years, which then meant that contact tracing was also decentralized. So it wasn't just within the head office. And that meant that contact tracers and public health officers knew exactly what was going on in their region. But New South Wales had a lot of contact tracers. At one stage, I think 700, but they could also call on the Australian Defence Force to increase that.
Sitting here in the United States speaking to you, it sounds to me that you are describing another planet, to be quite frank, right? Because this country right now is the global hotspot for the COVID pandemic. I have to ask, what is the global health community saying about the United States, honestly?
It's been a great sadness, actually. You've got one person dying every 30 seconds. So it's a great sadness. And for those of us who aren't American, our hearts are bleeding. We just can't believe it, because in Australia, in Europe, we always looked at America to lead science. We always did. I mean, I've even been to CDC. All epidemiologists went to CDC, went to a Mecca, and to think that CDC has been silenced is surprising, because America is so philanthropic when it comes to science. I mean, you led us to getting the rover on Mars and get to the moon. We're grieving for you, because, you know, America does lead very well, and it doesn't lead by bullying. It leads by providing innovation and inspiration. And at the moment, it's not there, but we know it will come back.
Mary Louise McClaws. She's an epidemiologist at the University of New South Wales in Sydney and a member of the WHO's Expert Advisory Panel for Infection Prevention, Readiness, and Response to COVID-19. Dina Rosendorf, manager at ABC Radio Melbourne there in Melbourne. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you lived in the United States for several years. Just pick up on that last thought from Mary Louise. I mean, when you look at what's happening in the US, Dina, like how do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, Meghna, as you know, I have a special place in my heart for America. We lived there. It was so, you know, the country was good to me. My second child was born in Boston and is a US citizen. And it's a country that when you live elsewhere in the Western world, America appears as the peak of civilization. But it feels to me, as Mary Louise mentioned, that looking from the outside in, that all the qualities associated with American individualism, qualities which I once admired, they're letting you down right now. And you can blame the administration for some of that division, but not all of it. It doesn't matter if you have the smartest doctors or the best hospitals, but if you don't have a community working together to support one another, it's irrelevant. And so I guess my hope for America now is that you guys can come together and indulge in a bit of introspection, some soul searching, and so that once again, you can return to prioritizing the greater good, because as we've seen in Australia, you are all stronger when you're together.
Mm. Well, I mean, truer words have not yet been spoken, Dina, and I thank you for it. So let's look forward for a little bit in Australia itself, because one thing that Mary Louise McClaws did tell me last night is that she's actually a little bit concerned now that the restrictions are being significantly relaxed in Australia. She'd prefer to see mandatory mask wearing in more places, public transit, etc. And it's the Christmas holidays coming up, and where like in the United States, it's a time of great gathering in Australia. So how does the immediate future look? Are people going to be willing to practice the kind of safety measures that you've had to do for so many months in order to keep those numbers low?
Well, it's really interesting because, of course, Victoria suffered the most. We were like the pariah in terms of all the states, you know. We had the leak in hotel quarantine, and that's why we needed to go back into that second really harsh lockdown. And so we've worked doubly as hard as the rest of the country. And so it is really frightening for me and my fellow Victorians that with restrictions easing and the federal government now starting to allow international arrivals back into the country, that of course they have to go through hotel quarantine. They have to quarantine for 14 days in a hotel when they arrive, and they're regularly tested. But there are still flaws in that system. We saw an example just last week where some German, they're actually Australian citizens. They have dual national, they're dual nationals. So they were a mother and son from Germany, but they have Australian citizenship, and they came from internationally, and they managed to slip through and were walking around lost at the airport until a security guard spotted them and said, are you okay? And they said, oh, we're looking for somewhere to quarantine. And that freaked everyone out, because had this security guard not caught them, and they were willing to do the right thing, so, you know, in fairness to them. But you know, they could have gone out into the community, and we could have had undetected the virus could have been undetected in the community. We wouldn't have known how that would happen. So we are really nervous. We've worked too hard to get to this point. But, you know, it's got to happen. We can't live like this forever. I guess the hope is that the vaccine is on its way, and that if we can just get through the next number of months, that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to have the vaccination sooner rather than later. So we certainly, I've got friends who have gone to Sydney, and it's the cognitive dissonance of getting off a plane there and people are not socially distancing because they haven't had to for quite some time. They're not wearing masks, and it freaks people from Victoria out.
Wow. Well, Dina, stand by here for just a second, because when we come back, we'll hear a little bit more from someone who stayed in one of those quarantine hotels in Australia, and we'll bring this conversation home, back here to the United States, about what lessons, if any, can be applied to this country, specifically now that California is back in lockdown. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about how Australia did it. How right now they have a tiny number of cases, just 6 new COVID positive cases across the entire nation of Australia. And I'm joined today by Dina Rosendorf. She's with us from Melbourne, Australia. She's manager of ABC Radio Melbourne. And, you know, I'm talking about also whether there are lessons to be learned for us here in the United States. And I'm getting some pushback here on Twitter from Glenn Koenig, who says, as frustrating as it is here in the U.S., we are unique in the world for many reasons. Primary is our immense population, 330 million, third highest in the world. We can't scale up what smaller countries do and expect it to still work here. Get an engineer on the air, please. Okay, Glenn, all due respect, first of all, if you're going to tell me to get an engineer on over Twitter, I've got an engineering degree. I understand what scale is. I understand what it means. Okay? Australia is it's like 1/12 the population of the United States. True. But you also heard what Dina was talking about. When one family walks around in the airport in Australia looking for a place to quarantine, they take care of that family. So my point is Australia is doing what we could have done at the start. Maybe we can't do it now with more than 15 million cases of COVID here in the United States. But the largest country in the world, China, certainly did something. Am I suggesting that we do everything that communist China did? No. But I'm also suggesting that maybe we ought to be thinking about different ways that we could have acted and can act to do a better job for Americans. So sorry, Glenn, I don't even know who you are. I'm glad you listened to On Point, but that American exceptionalism really gets to me. It just does. And we're here to learn. We are here to learn from any positive example we can. Now, there are many people in Australia, Dina has mentioned this, who didn't like the lockdowns, who don't like the sacrifices they had to make to get to where they are with those minuscule number of cases. And we actually heard from them, too. So this is journalist Gerard Ryle. He had important work travel that required him to come to the United States and to Europe. And in order to get back into Australia, he was required to go straight from the tarmac to a special quarantine hotel room, or a hotel that the Australian government created. It was guarded by police. He could not leave. There were police at the doors. And he stayed there for the full 2 weeks before he could return to his home. Now, Gerard's meals were delivered to his door at the hotel. He received a mental health check-in daily. It was comfortable, but Ryle admits he also felt resentful for having to endure such strict control measures.
People here are willing to give up certain freedoms to gain this, I guess, and to try and combat the virus. I'm not sure that other countries would have done that. And I'm not sure it would have been possible to do, you know, if you weren't in an island in the middle of nowhere, like Australia is. You know, it's hard to compare. I mean, the weather here is beautiful because it's now summer. It's nice to be able to run without a mask on, to enjoy all the privileges of restaurants and gatherings and everything. But I realize that the world isn't, it really isn't like that. And there were things we had to give up. I mean, I really resented having to apply for a visa to leave the country because my whole working life is about moving from country to country. And I'm used to be able to, you know, getting on a plane, going away for 4 weeks, coming back for a while, going away again. I really did resent the loss of freedom. I was worried that I wouldn't be getting a visa. I realized that I'm one of the privileged few that were allowed to leave the country and come back again. I'm not sure everyone would be happy with that situation. But there's a lot of freedoms that you had to give up. I mean, at one point, everybody here was encouraged to download an app that basically is like a spy app on your phone, you know. And you now, if you want to go into, you know, a hairdressing salon or wherever, you've got to download an app to get in. It's the same with a restaurant. If you do go to a restaurant, you know, they monitor your movements a lot. Yeah, some people would not like this. And as a journalist, of course, I don't like being traced. I don't like people knowing where I'm going or who I'm meeting. It's actually quite an important thing for me. So you are giving up a lot of what I think a lot of people would think of fundamental freedoms. So there's a price to pay here. It's not a price-free zone.
That's Gerard Ryle, investigative journalist and director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And we talked to him quite a bit. You can hear our extended conversation with him about his experience under government-required quarantine. Listen to that at onpointradio.org. So, Dina, hang on here with us for just a minute, because, as I said, I want to bring this conversation back here to the United States. And, yeah, maybe the lessons from Australia are not applicable now, at least, across the entire United States. But this week, California, 40 million people, at least almost all of California's 40 million people, went back into lockdown. So there at least is one very potent comparison point here for us to make. And joining us now from South Los Angeles is Jim Manja, president and CEO of St. John's Well Child and Family Center, a network of community health clinics in Southern California. Jim Manja, welcome to On Point. Jim, are you there?
Yes, thank you for having me. Mm.
So first of all, tell us, California's gone back into, you know, some form of lockdown. How would you describe what the lockdown is right now there?
It's kind of a semi-lockdown. It's a lot of it's the honor system. They're urging households that don't live together not to socialize, They have closed down the restaurants and even outdoor dining as well. But I think a lot of the lockdown is mostly going to impact folks who have the ability to quarantine at home and work at home. And most low-income Californians are still going to have to go to work and will still be getting infected.
So talk more about that, because is there adequate PPE? Has there been assistance for these folks to be protected?
Well, there is no mandate for employers to provide PPE for their employees. And that's one of the big reasons that we've had such a huge amount of infection, particularly in South LA, where, you know, most of our patients at St. John's are frontline essential workers, garment workers, factory workers, grocery workers. And so there is no employer mandate. And I think that was, even in this latest lockdown, I think that was what was missed and should have been part of it.
So can I just turn back to Dina in Melbourne for a second? Because, Dina, I didn't ask you about this before, but, I mean, Australia, too, has essential workers that the economy cannot function without. I presume that they were not under lockdown during those 4 months, at least in Melbourne, were they?
Yeah, well, you needed to have a permit to be able to travel for work. So you had to be deemed to be an essential worker to be able to leave your house and go to work. And so, yes, of course, people who worked in aged care, in hospitals, for myself in the media, we were deemed essential. So we were able to go to work if we had to.
Okay. And so I presume... Maybe I shouldn't presume anything in this day and age, but for hospital workers and things like that, were they adequately protected with PPE, Dina?
Oh, during the lockdown, during the height of the pandemic here, people were really worried that they weren't adequately protected and that, you know, PPE, there wasn't enough PPE, that the correct surgical masks weren't being supplied to frontline doctors. So, of course, we did have those concerns, but, you know, I think that they were all addressed within due course and, you know, we made it through. Mm.
So Jim Manja in South Los Angeles, what kind of infection rates are you seeing there?
Well, we're testing 500 to 600 people a day, sometimes 700 people a day. There's lines, you know, around the block. For people to get tested, and many, many people have symptoms. And we're seeing positivity rates as high as 25 and 30% on any given day. So that's more than 100 people a day that we then have to initiate contact tracing. Those at high risk will get monoclonal antibody infusion. But it's a massive effort, and the positivity rates are climbing to alarming rates.
Mm. And as you said, amongst the people who have no choice and who don't have the means or the privilege to stay home in the midst of yet another lockdown, which I think is supposed to last for, 3 weeks or so at least?
Yeah, it's supposed to go through Christmas. But yes, I think your point is important, which is that most of the people who are bearing the brunt of the COVID pandemic, which are primarily African American and Latino and low-income communities of color, do not have the luxury of quarantining at home. And they're also not going to places to work that are safe. And I think what the state really needs to do is mandate that employers provide protective equipment to every single worker. And that's how we're going to get a handle on this. Huh. Until we do that, the positivity rates in low-income communities throughout the country are going to continue to soar. And the Black and Latino communities are going to continue to bear the brunt of COVID infection, hospitalization, and death.
Yeah. You know, you heard me a little earlier kind of unload on poor Glenn Koenig, who sent us that tweet about my anger about American exceptionalism. So let's just give Glenn the benefit of the doubt there and say, okay, maybe we can't do anything across the entire United States now, but we're focusing our lens to California. Let's even focus it further just to Los Angeles, where you are, Jim. Is there anything that you heard in the Australian example from what Dina was sharing, for example? I mean, Melbourne has 5 million people there. Is there anything that you heard from Australia that you think we could or should, import as an idea to get a handle on the pandemic here?
Well, I think, you know, there's so many things that have been disjointed from the very beginning. I mean, I think, yes, of course, to answer your question directly, but if I could go around a bit to get there, you know, first issue was that we couldn't get test swabs to even do testing because the Trump administration made a decision in March to send those test swabs to the for-profit commercial labs. So the test swabs went to the areas that had the highest insurance payouts. Then we were finally, you know, we were able to negotiate with a local lab and get test swabs. Then there was the issue, you know, of the lack of contact tracing. And then there was, you know, the politicization of the mask in this country. So it feels like everything that's been done, the polarization that's been created by this administration and the abject failure made it impossible for us to be in control of this virus. So I think theoretically, yes, there are many things that that Australia did that we could have done and we could continue to do, but it's not going to happen. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce is much too powerful in California. So they're the ones that are pushing back against mandating that employers provide PPE to their employees. And so, you know, I think most of us are holding our breath and praying for the vaccine, because at this point, I don't see anything that's being done that's going to really bend this curve and flatten this curve. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, the Black and Latino communities are bearing the brunt of it.
Yeah. Anything including the sort of lockdown that you have right now?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, for those of us who have the luxury of staying at home, you know, it's great. And obviously people are frustrated and, you know, people are violating various aspects of it. There's virtually no enforcement. But the fact is, if we don't, in my opinion, if, you know, from what I've seen, and we've been doing this now since March on the front lines, if we don't get masks and protective gear to frontline employees, if we don't mandate that, we are not going to get a handle on this. And that's the reality in the United States and certainly in California.
Dina, Jim there mentioned sort of hoping and praying for the vaccine. I wanted to talk with you for a minute about that very issue in Australia, because back in August, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison in a radio interview said that he would make the COVID-19 vaccine mandatory in Australia for as many Australians as possible.
Would you be prepared to make it vaccination mandatory?
Well, certainly, we've got to get about 95%. And so we'd be applying that as, well, taking medical advice, that's the obvious answer to that, Neil, but that's what I would be expecting.
You would expect it to be mandatory?
I would expect it to be as mandatory as you can possibly make it. There are always exemptions for any vaccine on medical grounds, but that should be the only basis. I mean, we're talking about a pandemic that has destroyed, you know, the global economy and taken the lives of you know, hundreds of thousands all around the world, and over 430 Australians here. So, you know, we need the most extensive and comprehensive response to this to get Australia back to normal.
So that's the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, in a radio interview in August. And that 430 Australian deaths he mentioned was as of August. I think now it's at about 900 or 908 total. But Dina, we've just got about a minute here. Has there been pushback to Morrison suggesting that vaccination should be mandatory?
Yes, and there are the same concerns here about the vaccine as there are in the US. And I would say that he's backtracked from those comments. So a little bit later in the day, he came out and he had to clarify and say it's not going to be compulsory to have the vaccine. And it was sort of suggested as well later on that he wouldn't necessarily even have the power to make it mandatory. So we're closely watching what's happening in the UK with their vaccination program. And I imagine there'll be more of a take up here in Australia when the vaccine does arrive, if it seems to be going well in the UK.
Mm. Well, I mean, we've been talking all hour about the Australians' willingness to sort of band together for the common good. Do you expect that?
It's
same?
Ironic, right? Because, you know, we come from we're built from a nation of convicts. It's quite ironic that we're such rule followers now.
You're the second Australian who mentioned that part of the country's history. I wasn't even going to go there, Dina, but... Oh, okay, well, Jim Monge, I've got 10 seconds left with you. Is the vaccine the only hope really now?
I think it is. Again, I think, you know, these lockdowns will have some impact, and hopefully they will. But yes, it's about the vaccine and getting it into the hands of the frontline health providers as soon as possible to vaccinate people.
Well, Jim Monge is president and CEO of St. John's Well Child and Family Center, a network of community health clinics in Southern California. California, again, in lockdown. Thank you so much for joining us, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
And Dina Rosendorf, manager of ABC Radio Melbourne. Dina, thank you so much for taking us to Australia. It has been so great to talk to you once again. Thank you.
It's been great talking with you, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.